You're listening to 1001 Album Club, where each episode we discuss a different album from Robert Emery's book, 1001 Albums You Must Hear Before You Die. This episode, we'll be talking about teenage fan club bandwagon-esque. In the room, I have Rob.
Oh, yeah.
And Jeremy.
Hello.
And on the line, I have Ben.
Oh, yeah.
And Kyle.
Hi there.
Bandwagon-esque is the third album by Scottish alternative rock band Teenage Fan Club, released on November 1991 on Creation Records. The producer was Don Fleming, and the genre is alternative rock, power pop, jangle pop, and noise pop. I'm going to read from the book. Mark Bennett. A band for which the word quirky may have been invented, Teenage Fan Club had always possessed an infuriating knack of confounding expectations. They promised so much with 1990s, a Catholic education, and the majestic Everything Flows, but celebrated joining the prestigious Creation label with The King, a frankly rubbish set of instrumental covers. Having tested the patience of a once supportive musical press, the knives were drawn for the fannies when they released their masterpiece. That's what they call them.
Yeah, I hate it.
The fannies?
That's unfortunate.
Yeah. Teenage Fan Club, fannies.
I hate it.
Like, they're the pussies? Like,
yeah.
The American?
Yeah.
Cool. Nice.
I'm gonna
not your bum, but your that one.
Okay. A high watermark for the British indie scene obsession with the past. Bandwagon-esque. Was steeped in rock tradition. Neil Young, Love, The Birds, The Beach Boys, Big Star, even a half-ironic nod to status quo. Yet the critics, who thought it was acceptable for Primal Scream to impersonate the Rolling Stones, little matter that bandwagon-esque was more consistently great than number one record. This was a time when dance music, shoegazing, and the faded Manchester fad still ruled. The fannies were labeled unimaginative, only for Suede and Oasis to be heralded as the future of British rock. Oh, the irony. Bandwagon-esque has so many highlights that you forget is a single album. Three indisputable classic 90s indie singles, The Concept, Star Sign, What You Do to Me, three beautiful tearjerkers, December, Guiding Star, and the instrumental Is This Music, harmonies that would make Brian Wilson blush, and a warm, overdriven edge that united Sonic Youth with the Archies. Beat that, Kurt Cobain. All right, what do we think of Teenage Fan Club bandwagon-esque?
Well, I'll be the one to say it this week. This is a fucking masterpiece.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Why have I never dug into Teenage Fan Club?
I guess we can blame Jeremy.
Yeah. He didn't get any of us into this band.
I listened to it this week and I was like, oh. And then I kept listening. And I was like, oh. Mm-hmm. And then it just kept going. Like every song, I was like, oh.
Every song.
It just keeps going.
This is going to be one of the best moments of me listening to you guys ever. Oh, I love it.
But yeah, just from the start, this is very weird for 1991. I just wasn't expecting a Big Star kind of throwback jangle pop from Scottish lads.
Yeah.
I feel like an asshole because I've always been like, Teenage Fan Club. Yeah, right.
Thought
about them for more than a second.
I knew the album cover. I did not know that this is what it sounded like. And I wish I had spent my youth in the 90s listening to this.
I tell you what, you seem like a much more well-balanced person than I am. But I spent my youth in the 90s listening to this. This album was everything to me in 91. And for many years after.
From the needle drop. And then the concept, fucking awesome song. If you take that coda off of it, it's still an awesome song.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that coda outro is, I love it. It just swirls around and gives me goosebumps. And they're just playing those guitars and they sound so big and beautiful. It's awesome.
It's all Big Star, baby.
Did read this album referred to as Big Star's fourth, which I thought was really funny.
Oh, that's awesome.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I did
see them perform a couple songs on the Dennis Miller show.
Whoa.
And I was like, whoa, Dennis Miller used to be kind of cool once. years ago.
They were on Saturday Night Live and stuff, too. Yeah. It's just, I don't know. Some people said, too, that Scottish bands just don't have a desire to be famous.
Oh, tell them the Proclaimers.
Oh, God.
Is that where Franz Ferdinand came from?
That they just kind of like, if we get famous, fine, but... At least this band, you know, at least Teenage Fan Club, it wasn't that they thought, you know, oh, yeah, we're going to be the next Big Star. We're going to be the next, you know, huge band.
I don't think anyone's goal should be to be the next Big Star. A band that notoriously never saw their own success.
Yeah,
it's a very sad story.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was listening to a couple tracks. I played a couple tracks for Claire, who had never heard Teenage Fan Club. And she was like, oh, I bet Weezer liked this band.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing. That's the thing. When I was in the 90s and Weezer was my favorite band and I was done listening to Weezer and I was looking for the next thing. I didn't know older people. I don't have any older siblings. I was going to the CD store and it's like, I didn't have a map. I didn't have a map to aim me to the bands that were, I was searching for a sound and I didn't find it until I went to college.
It was Super Chunk.
It was Super Chunk.
Yeah. Super Chunk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was Super Chunk. And I knew I missed Super Chunk. But I did not know until this week that I missed Teenage Fan Club too.
Yeah, me neither. I thought the song in Narcan's right now is like, is this a Big Star cover?
Oh yeah, there's several songs. Yeah, I was like, there's a couple.
This is just a, no, it's not. It just sounds exactly like Alex Chilton.
Yeah. So my favorite thing is I was gifted Teenage Fan Club by the same guy who got me into Public Enemy.
Nice.
Who had terrible taste in music. But he gave me this tape because he's like, I saw the video on MTV. It was pretty cool. And it's kind of a weird album. I thought you might like it. Oh.
What an angel.
Oh, did I like it? I think I burned through my copy of the copied cassette in like 6 months and had to go buy their music. But I became obsessed and got everything. I have a really stupid Teenage Fan Club collection.
Can I just go chronologically? I know that this one is a departure from the sound of the first one. I know Catholic Education is not as power-poppy.
It's dirtier. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, because they didn't have any money.
Are there any, like, do they have weak spots, or can I just follow them for their career?
So 13 is the fourth. Well, okay, real fans don't count The King, the second album. It was one of those toss stuff off for a contract. Just to get
it
out
was
of it.
So some they covers sign they recorded during these same sessions, right?
Okay, so the album's like 9 noise songs that they just fucked around and played, and then they did a cover of Like a Virgin, which is actually dope.
Yeah.
They did Interstellar Overdrive, which is just noisy.
Ooh, whoa, yeah. Okay.
So there's like 3 or 4 good tracks on a really dumb, here's some us playing in a basement yelling. Like,
so, yeah, I heard
just to fulfill the
contract stuff.
But, I have The King.
But also Don Fleming, who, you know, worked with a ton of people, including like Sonic Youth.
Don Fleming did the Posies' best album. Yeah. He did, well, his own band Gumball. Mm-hmm. He did Ball with Jay Maskus and, oh, Velvet Monkeys with Jay Maskus and Thurston Moore. He's a way better producer than a songwriter, but like his production is this.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And
it's gorgeous.
I heard some stories from The King that he thought it was funny that anytime they didn't have a song, they would just try and play a cover.
And they didn't know the songs.
And the joke was they didn't know the songs and they were just trying to remember the lyrics.
And so it's some borderline unlistenable basement jams with barely any lyrics and then the beautiful Like a Virgin cover.
Yeah.
Which I do have on vinyl.
Awesome.
Not The King, because you can't get it, but like, it's on a single they did, an EP or something, is the Like a Virgin.
Nice.
I didn't know you could do melodic things with feedback.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they were like, hey, we have a Turbo Rat. Look what you can do with it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I bought a Turbo Rat was because on the inside cover of this album, Gerard Love is holding one up. And I was like, I must have that pedal. I saved up for it and bought it when I was like 17 years old.
What does it do?
It's a distortion.
Oh, okay.
I used only Turbo Rats in Tremendous after I got rid of the Big Muff. So,
okay.
I had 3 different versions of it, and I would chain them together. So that's you can do this, Mm-hmm. Or you can do that.
The melodic warblings of Tremendous Fuck. the jangle pop.
The gentle jangle pop.
The jangle pop.
Of drop D gnarliness.
It's this record's so jangly.
It's a versatile pedal.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I love the jingle jangle just next to all the other 91 stuff.
And they're very birds vocals. Like, I love.
Oh, yeah. Especially here. We're listening to I Don't Know right now, which.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That just slapped me in the face with birds vocals first time I heard it. Yeah. Which I'm here for.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I like the birds harmonies. I just don't like anything else about the birds. I was really excited to hear like these beautiful harmonies on this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, this sounds like the birds. When I was talking to Todd at the club, and I was talking about Teenage Fan Club. He's like, I'm not familiar with them. I was like, yeah, it's kind of like Big Star and the birds, but 90s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very.
He's spot on. My first impression of like influences, like definitely Big Star. I got to Jayhawks before I got to birds, but Jayhawks are a direct tangent to birds as well. But then it's got those thick, like late 80s, 90s, like Dinosaur Jr. tones.
Yeah.
You know, just like the walls of yeah.
Yeah, it's a little dirty too. It's got that sort of.
It's a little. It's got hair on it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think that's some of the magic of Fleming's production is.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, these guitars sounded gross in certain points, and it's just so shimmery. Like, you know, there was a crunch to whatever amp they were using that it just all together just is this almost orchestral reverbed glow. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Although the guitars, I will say, each track probably only has 2-3 guitars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's not like, they're not stacking Mm-mm. like 5-10 guitars.
No, because they're panned like at
yeah.
10 and 2, and you can tell it's just like the two guys' rhythm style.
Yeah.
Until the solo comes.
Most of it's live, too.
Yeah.
Someone pointed out, too, that, you know, it's kind of strange that Big Star spent so long, you know, getting that perfect sound, and these guys go in 2 weeks, create this.
Yeah.
Big Star should have just hired child producer Don Fleming.
Funny things about the Big Star connection is, so I was all about Fan Club, and then like the dude at high school, the older guy who was got into it with me, he's like, so I got this book and it talks about bands' influences, and they talk about this band Big Star, so I got this Big Star album, you should listen to it. And I listened to it and I was like, yeah, it's kind of like a 70s band doing 60s stuff, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
So many years later, there was a benefit at Second Story that was done under like British bands, and
we did
Fan Club.
Oh right,
we did this.
Oh,
most of this album and a couple other songs.
I have that poster.
And so as we're learning the songs, I mean, like I'm playing them I've played them.
Yeah.
But we're learning them to where they can play it and I can do the vocals. And, you know, so we have to change a couple keys. And as I'm playing these, I'm like, oh, this is fucking Big Star.
Yeah.
And Johnny Yuma and Scott Van Buren look at me and they're like, yeah, obviously. And I was like, I never really.
That's awesome.
It was so, because I had such a like reverence for this album and just what it did to me, and then what it did to me, and then like, and then I also loved Big Star by the time, but it's just until I played it. And yeah. Like, oh.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, they even sample an Alex Chilton interview on one of the B-sides of the What You Do to Me single.
Yeah.
As it's he's talking about, do you find that playing music like this is anachronistic? And then he goes, I don't know. I just like playing what sounds good to my ears. And then it starts the song. And I didn't know that.
That's a good quote.
Yeah. It's on the Maharishi Dug the Scene, if you ever want to deep dive on their B-sides.
All right.
Those are good, too.
Man, What You Do to Me, that is a perfect 2-minute nugget.
With only like 9 words.
I had heard that song somewhere before. Is that
right?
Was that featured in something? I knew that song.
It sounded very familiar to me.
Yeah.
You guys ever listen to, like, Rhino put out, or I guess it was out before Rhino. Rhino re-released the Nuggets box sets.
Oh, yep.
Yeah, we talked about Nuggets.
What You Do to Me would fit in perfectly on any of those Nuggets collections.
Yeah.
You know?
I think I think a lot of bands that came through in the 90s were listening to those Nuggets re-releases, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. When Rhino was doing the re-releases, people were thinking, oh, shit. The 13th floor elevators are awesome. You know, like,
oh, that was
people were digging into that stuff more because they didn't have the original 45s. Yeah. You know, it was
so many of those bands were just regionally successful.
Right.
Like, if you didn't live outside, if you lived 300 miles outside of Tacoma, you wouldn't have heard much of it. You know, like,
no, I remember like in the early 90s when people were talking about, like, you know, modern rock and the alternative kind of revolution. A lot of people who are older were like, this is just the 70s again.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
We're just trying to, and that, which back then I remember hearing that being like the 70s because that was, you know, before I was born. And then now, you know, oh, it was like 20 years ago. It'd be like if somebody was, you know,
hey, oh, this is like the early 2000s again.
Yeah. If somebody like, came oh, out no. and like please, did no, Limp Bizkit no. again, you know.
Yeah. What track's in our cans right now?
This sign. Is Star Sign.
Star Sign.
Yeah, this reminded me of The Laws.
Oh, sure. Nice. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Which makes sense.
Yeah.
But no, it's just like, just a perfect little tasty pop nugget.
Yeah.
They're nuggets, man.
Ugh.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It's just gross. It's gross how good this band
so on
is.
This,
dude.
McGinley's main instrument on the album is a 1963 Starburst Fender Jaguar bought for £265.
Makes sense.
And then Blake had not found his primary guitar, but he was playing a 1970 Gibson ES-335, so acquired for £300. So they're playing these like relatively inexpensive guitars for the time, but
So cheap guitar, turbo rat, and a good amp probably.
Wait, yeah. has a Gibson ES-335 ever been considered cheap? It's like a high end Gibson, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, but they apparently acquired it.
Got a good deal.
Got a good deal.
Some pawn
yeah.
shop.
Yeah. And then he later got a 1962 Epiphone Casino for, again, £300. So they're basically like pawn shop,
yeah.
like going to the pawn shop, getting the like cheap guitars, but they sound great.
That's not what I find at my pawn shops.
Well, £300 sterling is not cheap in 1990. Like, that's still fucking expensive.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like, it's not like $1,000.
Yeah, $1,200. It's not like buying a Rickenbacker or something.
Yeah.
Maybe. A Casino is very famously a Beatle guitar, so I could kind of see the... I mean, if they're channeling Big Star and Big Star's channeling the Beatles, I could kind of see the appeal of a Epiphone Casino.
You don't know about guitars, keyboard man.
Are you talking to me while yes. I look up the pound sterling yeah. versus the US dollar in 1991 yeah. right now?
Even if it was double, even if it was two to one, that's still $600 for a fucking 62 Casino.
Yeah.
That's cheap.
Even considering it's $691, it's still cheap.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Guitars are expensive, man.
Guitars are expensive.
Especially when you're looking at like those... Not prestige, but like a specific yeah. type of guitar that they maybe only made, I don't know, 30,000 of, and they've all sold.
Yeah.
And that mid-century American craftsmanship, it's highly sought after. They literally don't make them like they used to.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. In 1992, £1 was worth $1.5265.
Yeah. So 300 would be what?
450.
450. And change.
$450 for a 1962 Epiphone.
Now
casino?
Add inflation.
Doesn't matter. I bought my guitar in 2000 or whatever. More than that.
In 2022, I don't have a price guide right in front of me, but I would estimate a 60s Gibson ES-335 would probably be like $10,000.
Oh, for real?
I don't know. See, like a 60s Gibson? Like it's a hollow body.
For a piece of hollow wood?
Yeah. 1970s Gibson?
Because nothing sounds like that.
Anyway, we're getting off track. But
okay, so
I would say
this
five grand. I would say like 10 times less.
That's dentist money.
I know. That's why. It's those people are the people who are buying those fucking for that much.
Gibsons are the dentist version of magic cards for crypto bros.
Now, he did buy it. The 1963 Fender Jaguar was for $265. I mean, oh, but still, that's...
I mean, wasn't the Jaguar what Cobain was playing and breaking all the time?
Yeah.
Jazzmaster. Yep.
No,
his was a Jagstang.
Jagstang.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, so...
I guess it's just a thing you could pick up pretty easily.
Something fun about this, as I would play along with these songs in my bedroom as a teenager, 3/4 of these songs do the same thing.
Okay.
Chord-wise. But it doesn't sound like it, and it all works. So they do this thing where they do the descend from, like, say, a C down, like C, B down to the A minor, then a G, then a D.
Okay.
But they do it in, like, all keys. But a lot of the songs you'll hear is like, dun, 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 and it works perfectly.
Huh.
But because I remember we were learning them, and I was writing out the stuff for the band. I was like, okay, so it's kind of like the other one, but in C. But in a different tempo, and the melody is completely different.
It works though.
Yeah, it totally works. And then there's these other, like this one, which has that boom, 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 boom.
Which one is this?
Pet Rock.
Yeah.
Sidewinder's next. I remember this.
Yeah.
So
I was worried. I was worried. I was overestimating. I looked up a current listing for a '60s era ES-335, $14,000 marked down from $18,500.
That's
for a 1965 Sunburst.
That is a dental franchise amount of money.
ES-335.
And it's going right on the wall.
Yep.
Yeah.
So the grandkids can look at it.
Yeah.
So I will pay £300 sterling any day of the week.
Yeah.
All right. Let's get the time machine.
So yeah, obviously this recalled a lot of earlier bands, Orange Juice, Aztec Camera, the whole Scottish scene, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's so cool. The amount of bands we're getting just in the book from this tiny place.
Yeah.
Is,
man, how about Creation Records in 91?
And Creation Records, yeah.
The Isle of Scott?
I got obsessed with Scottish bands because of this.
Yeah.
So the next thing I found was a band called Eugenius, which they've played together. Mm-hmm. Like, they've played on each other's albums. They had a band called BMX Bandits where they were together. Eugenius is Eugene Kelly from the Vaselines.
Yep.
And I love both of those albums and the two EPs that they did after. And it's the same, like, Fleming. Oh, so that's one of the things.
Dragons.
I couldn't wait to talk about because Eugene Kelly had I think it was Alternative Press before they went, what was it, like, steampunk metal or whatever. But, like, they actually covered a wide range of every kind of this stuff that was coming out. But there was, one of the little side interviews with him, and he made some comment about quoting Picasso or something, you know, great artist or great artist steal, whatever. Mm-hmm. There's songs on... I think it's Umalama, the Eugenius debut, where he direct rips riffs from both Gumball with Don Fleming and Fan Club. At like the beginning of songs, it's like, this is that song, and then it turns into another song. Or there's like a solo that's way too much like what you just heard right there.
Yeah.
And it's like he's ripping off his friends and being like, I love it. It's so great. And I got into all the Scottish bands, like Trash Can Sinatra's and Orange Juice and all those. But
that's awesome.
It's so cool. Yeah, it's like...
Mogwai?
Towns. That was later.
That was later.
Mogwai. Yeah. Love me post-rock. I had a whole post-rock life after this.
BMX Bandits was named after the Nicole Kidman film.
I would hope
so.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they didn't. That's the greatest thing. It's like almost everything they do is like a reference to something.
Yeah, great
like
lyrics.
Like Family Guy.
We hadn't talked about the lyrics, but.
Lyrics are... Beautiful.
Wonderful.
There's some cheesy ones, but it doesn't matter because it's so sincere, you know?
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
Okay, like this, the Sidewinder.
Yeah.
Tweet your shit, man.
I love the way you walk. I love the way you talk. Like, okay, I have felt like that
a
million times.
You're my tick and I'm your talk or something?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's a little
when
silly.
You're tick and I'm your talk.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is adorable and means something totally different now, and I hate it.
Oh, yeah, because of the app.
Teenage Fan Club, if you're listening, sell this to TikTok for $1 billion.
What is there a story behind the title of the concept? What's the concept? Was it like, a mission statement for the album? I know it was a change in sound.
I have a quote from Brendan O'Hare from in the book. It says, "The concept behind the concept is there is no concept."
Yeah.
So it's just a word that they're like, yeah, let's call a song this, and then they wrote that song.
They said that they wrote it
1991, baby. Now,
in an interview, he said that he wrote it like 20 minutes before they were recorded.
I don't doubt it.
Which was the fashion at the time.
Because they have a thing that they do, and sometimes the words just come out. You know this.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, oh, well, I'm not touching that. Probably the best song I ever wrote, I just like improvised into a tape recorder. I was like, I'm not changing a thing.
Yeah.
It didn't even mean to, you know.
And you can just channel that divine feed, man. So how about the album title? I made up my own story behind it, but I it's probably wrong. I also know that Don Fleming was convincing them to polish up their sound a little bit, to add the harmonies, to lean more in a pop direction. It seems like in the early 90s, the quote unquote selling out was such a hot button issue.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if this this previously noisy band releasing a more pop sounding album, if that's behind like the bandwagon-esque, like jumping on the bandwagon.
And on a major label.
That's the thing, the DGC
Creation?
Signing
no,
craze.
No.
DGC.
DGC.
So post-Nirvana, all these bands got picked up by DGC.
That's the David Geffen Company.
Because Sonic Youth gave them cred.
Yes. So all these bands, and everyone hated at first those first albums on DGC, but they were all like the best albums of their career.
Yeah.
And this one, also Alcohol Day is the greatest song, now that that's
pretty. Yeah.
But I think because grunge was so huge and they did a more slick pop thing, that bandwagon-esque is both, yes, what you said, Ben, but also kind of ironic because they were doing the opposite of what grunge was doing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
They're doing here's really well-produced big star. Fuck y'all.
Yeah. Also
the unapologetic pop, yeah.
Bag on the cover,
which is from that's from a Gene Simmons thing.
Yeah, I learned this week that Gene Simmons owns the Moneybag logo. Yeah.
So they put it on the album cover of their first major label album.
Yeah, so they used clip art. That is a clip art that they used for the album cover.
That one, I saw an artist credited.
The artist used some sort of, I think it was like,
was Microsoft. It Mr. Print Shop?
It's something. But yeah, you're right that somehow Gene Simmons has copyrighted a money bag.
In 1991, he had owned the money bag symbol for decades. It's like when he was young, he's like, I should probably buy this. Who knows? It'll probably
what
come
the hell
handy.
Are you guys talking about? This can't be true.
It's totally true.
They had to pay.
Like the bag with the dollar sign on it?
Yes. Gene Simmons owns that image.
That image, but specifically though, right?
And it simply can't be true.
It just said that he
can't be the concept.
I mean,
Bandwagon-esque comes out. Gene Simmons shows up out of nowhere. He's like, actually, I own that. And Creation cuts him a check. And then Gene Simmons goes away.
Yeah.
I just want to wet my beak.
Exactly. He wants to wet his beak. Sharon Fitzgerald.
Yes,
designed the cover of Bandwagon-esque.
Yeah. And this says, when Kiss member Gene Simmons, who had trademarked the logo of a money bag with dollar symbol, was made aware, the record he sent a letter to Geffen.
Christ, what an asshole.
I just don't understand how you, like, copyright.
I don't know.
Like, can I copyright, like, star eyes in a cartoon or something?
Paris Hilton tried to copyright That's Hot.
Gene Simmons says that he had been using it on just, like, various ventures. He's been, like, various, like, books he would put out or albums he would record. He would often have, like, the little dollar sign logo on it. And he bought the trademark to it. And he now, in like the mid-2000s, he he opened a clothing line, and that's the logo of his clothing line. He's like, well, I already own this, so we should probably just use this.
Now, I guess I should ask you, Ben, you're more familiar. Now, is it this specific money bag with the dollar sign? Yeah.
No, it's a different money bag with the dollar sign.
Does that make any sense?
No.
It's a different money bag with a dollar sign, but it's still a money bag with a dollar sign. And he owns the money bag with the dollar sign.
So did like Disney have to go pay him back money?
I don't know. We should do a Patreon episode about the story of Gene Simmons and the bag with the dollar sign.
I want to copyright like a bottle with three X's on it.
Yeah.
Could I do
that? Gene Simmons already has that.
Yeah.
No, and anecdotally on this Gene Simmons thing, when some bums went out to California, like on tour, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang was a night that Bang Sugar Bang had been putting on, and Gene Simmons was suing them over the name Kiss.
Did he do litigious. The movie guys too? What's his name?
Does he also send Shane a letter Black? To Kiss of the Spider Woman and
Prince for writing song Kiss?
Yeah.
Probably. Tom Jones for covering it.
All people that kiss.
He's a quadrillionaire.
He's litigious.
I'm so upset that Gene Simmons has like.
Hey, is this like over is this a podcast. Big break of character for Gene Simmons for you, Kyle?
We were talking about Teenage Fan Club, and now we're talking about fucking Kiss.
Yeah, let's talk about. Another one, Death Cab for Cutie. Ben Gibbard has declared this his favorite band, and he re-recorded this entire album.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
I totally forgot about that.
All right, who are the Death Cab for Cutie fans in the podcast?
Can't say that I've ever listened to them, Kyle.
Nope, never got into it.
Not once. I worked at a CD warehouse, and one of my coworkers was really into Death Cab for Cutie, and I could not stand this motherfucker.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got a young kid at home, and we play, you know, just like kid songs on YouTube, like it just streams like kid song cartoons. And there are these ones, but it's by this bear called Blue Bagoo. And I swear it's a Ben Gibbard side project. This dude, he sounds like Ben Gibbard singing baby songs. I wouldn't blame him either.
I mean,
why not?
You're streaming it.
Yeah, here I am listening to Blue Bagoo.
Getting them baby clicks.
That's right. All right, let's get back to the album.
Okay, so the end of this album, this song is just gorgeous, and I don't know.
Guiding Star.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely one we did at the second story set.
Yeah.
This has some of my favorite lines. So it talks about Jesus Christ, blah, blah, blah. And then it says, could his golden halo be the sun we all know? Mm-hmm. And I love that. I don't know why.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, that's pretty cool.
It's great. They have wonderful little phrases.
That's some real Catholic school shit.
Yeah.
And then they go, their first album, Catholic Educate. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which that whole thing is a rejection of. I love that album. The whole thing is a rejection of that whole everything.
Just like Operation Minecraft.
Just like it, Kyle. Thank you for bringing Minecraft into the mix.
Is that like a thing you have to do once every episode?
He's trying to.
Stop trying to make fetch a thing.
So Norman Blake wasn't even Catholic. He thought it'd be a subject matter that would divide crowds.
You know? Oh, that's interesting.
That'll work.
Yeah.
He's still doing crazy stuff. He's doing like 9 projects.
They just had an album come out.
Yeah, they keep doing it. And they're mostly good. I think there's one that I think is like okay, but all the other ones. Jim O'Rourke produced one of their albums, for Christ's sake.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's probably my...
They played with Half Japanese. I mean,
Jad Fair. Well, yeah. I remember seeing that Jad Fair Teenage Fan Club album cover, and I knew what Jad Fair sounded like.
That's the reason I didn't know that album.
Yeah, that was also why I didn't check it out. I'm like, okay, I've seen Band Would Be King. That's an interesting story, but I don't think I need to listen to it a whole bunch.
Yeah, they did 12-inch with Frank Black for the Peel Sessions. I've got that on vinyl.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
So we all, I think we're all on the positive on this one.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely.
This is incredible.
Yeah.
This is top 10 for me.
This is a revelation.
Easy.
Yeah.
And probably top 5.
This is just what I needed.
Yeah, absolutely. I say, yeah, this is definitely a welcome in 1991 when I was not.
I was just happy to not hear an oons, 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 oons.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, Ben, I thought about you.
At any point on this whole album.
I know I've brought this up before, but I was talking about like back in the 90s when I was listening to radio with my dad and Tom Petty would come on and he'd be like,
yeah, that's the feeling.
Sometimes you hear a lot of crazy music and then you hear some Tom Petty and you're like,
Yeah.
That's how I felt here in this. Like, I was, you know, after listening to fucking Primal Scream for an hour and a half.
Right.
I've got a question. Jeremy, do you have a favorite Teenage Fan Club songwriter?
Ooh, that's tough. No. But Blake does the really beautiful anthemic songs. Love is the... He's the, like, sad, pretty love longing songs. McGinley's
the... He's the star sign, too, right?
Yeah. And McGinley's the just, like, loose cat. He's, like... There's a song on the 13 bonus disc, which is actually, like, a B-side from one of the singles. But it's one of the most depressing for one of these types of bands songs. It's just so hopeless. And their whole thing is optimism and hope and love, right? And then there's a song like, if I feel like I'm fucked up. And you're like, whoa. So all the three main songwriters have kind of a distinct thing, really, once you get into the band. But I can't pick because together it's just so good. And even Brendan wrote songs before he left the band. He wrote one of the ones on this.
I saw, well, he's got a co-writing credit on Satan because the whole band does.
Well, yeah. Oh, maybe it wasn't. Maybe it's the next album, but he definitely wrote a song or two on before he quit the band.
That last track that we just heard that reminded me a lot of My Bloody Valentine.
I was going to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bershu brought that up.
I was wondering if that was a dig at them because the title is This Music?
Oh, you think it was a diss track?
Well, that's a...
And they're label mates.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Maybe it was a you know, friendly... Dick.
Yeah, I think it was.
But also maybe they were responding that people were saying that My Bloody Valentine wasn't proper music.
I think,
like,
so too, yeah,
purists.
Yeah.
And so they're like, well, we just made one and it's melodic because it's also not music. Because I don't know, they're very funny guys, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
Watch any interview with them, they're a trip.
Yeah. Awesome. So glad to have that one.
Bandwagon-esque, famously beat out Nevermind for Spin Magazine's Album of the Year 1991.
Man, makes sense.
Bonkers. But I love it.
Yeah. I could see that argument, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Which is
the perfect popper.
I wouldn't have thought that before listening to it, but...
I wouldn't have thought that last week, but I absolutely think that today.
Yeah. You can make that argument.
Yeah.
All right, next time we'll be talking about Metallica. All right. Thanks, y'all.
Yeah, yeah! I'll
take this chance to tell my... second.